a tragic Valentine's Day in Florida, marking the first anniversary of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school shooting. Good morning. We are live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and just ahead, reflecting on the past and looking ahead to the future, 1 year after the shootings in Parkland. Join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, they're filling the void in Northeast Florida as one local publication marks a big milestone. Plus, Valentine's Day poems for married people. The crazy successful new book. We'll share some of the hilarious poems later in the hour this Valentine's Day. All of that ahead, but first this hour, it is a somber Valentine's Day here in Florida. It was 1 year ago today that a mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School sparked a national youth protest movement to stop gun violence in America. The MSD students have become nationally known as they lead March for Our Lives. One of them, school shooting survivor David Hogg, appeared on NPR yesterday.
I feel like we've told our story, but it's become a much broader book. We've told one chapter of it, the inciting incident of it, but we are nowhere near the climax of it. The sad thing about this movement, when people always ask me, like, do you think this is really going to continue? Do you think that this is sustainable? Yes, because I meet more and more people every day who've lost children and friends and parents to gun violence in the United States. And until we get the laws that we're looking for, these stories are going to continue.
Now, Hogg joined other Parkland families this week in South Florida to file the first of what they hope will be more than 1 million petition signatures for a ballot amendment that would prohibit the possession and sale of assault-style weapons in this state. We are beginning the show this morning with a look back at the events of 1 year ago today and everything that's happened since then. As we welcome Jamie Rich, editor-in-chief of Flamingo Magazine and a Marjorie Stoneman Douglas alumni. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also in studio, Dr. Marie Crandall. She's a trauma surgeon, professor of surgery at UF's College of Medicine Jax, and a nationally renowned researcher on gun violence. Dr. Crandall, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And as we talk about the 1 year anniversary of the shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and everything that's happened since then, we want your calls and comments. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and you can also weigh in on our Facebook page. All right, in a moment, Jamie, we'll hear all about this special issue you have published this month from Flamingo Magazine, where you have exclusive interviews with the children who survived the school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. First, though, Dr. Crandall, I want to ask you, as someone who treats gun violence victims at UF Health here in Jacksonville and was actually the attending physician at the mass shooting at the Jacksonville Landing several months ago, as we mark this anniversary, it's been 1 year now. This debate has moved rapidly in Florida and across the country. As a trauma surgeon who deals with this up close, what are your thoughts this morning?
So, of course, I want to extend my heartfelt condolences to families who lost loved ones at Parkland, but also who lose loved ones daily. There are over 17,000 homicides in the United States every year, and about 12,000 of them are related to firearms. We, as a trauma surgeon, we see probably 500 to 800 victims of gun violence every year at our trauma center in Jacksonville. And we see what this does to individuals, their families, and communities. I went into researching and advocacy on this topic simply because I felt like to treat patients but to send them out without strategies to prevent this from happening again was similar to malpractice.
Let's talk about what's happened in Florida since Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. There have been a number of changes made to school safety regulations and procedures. A major law was passed, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School Safety Act, calling for more armed personnel on school grounds. Here is Governor Ron DeSantis, meanwhile, on Wednesday, calling for a statewide grand jury to investigate whether school districts are following the laws that have been enacted.
The best tool that we have to bring accountability,
but also move forward in a better way, is a petition that I filed today with the Florida Supreme Court for a statewide grand jury to look into not only the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas incident, but how this school district here and other school districts have handled money for security, have handled all of these issues that impact the safety of our schools.
Okay. Legislators, of course, last year passed a sweeping measure that includes some gun restrictions, also calls for more armed security at school campuses. And the Florida Senate now is considering a proposal to arm teachers in the classroom. Here is Frederick Ingram, the head of the Florida Education Association, representing the state's teachers, saying teachers are opposed to this idea.
Teachers do not want to be armed, and we know that that is not a panacea to the problem that we're having with these mass shootings. Putting more guns in our schools is not going to fix the problem. It is not going to divert any type of accident from happening. In fact, what it will do is present itself in a fashion that parents don't want to have their kids in the middle of a situation where a first-grade teacher is down at recess and she has a gun on her person and some mistake happens.
Okay, Dr. Crandall, how do you assess the state's response to the shooting and all of the mass shootings we've had in Florida in terms of how they have tried to enact measures to better protect students?
So I think that on the one hand, we're moving in the right direction. So there are many studies that have demonstrated that more restrictive licensing and background checks are associated with decreased risk of suicide and homicide, anywhere from 7% to 40%. And that has been shown for years. There's a direct association between stricter laws and decreased gun violence. The idea of arming teachers is less persuasive because we know that actually more guns are associated with more incidents. And if it were true that armed people keep people safer, then police officers and security guards would not be victims of mass shootings. And certainly we know that they are, and they have been in widely publicized incidents in the last year.
So it sounds as though what I hear you saying is you would prefer that schools focus more heavily on outreach to students, particularly troubled students?
I think
mental health support?
Yes, I think that that's really important. But again, I think mental health is absolutely a critical issue in the United States and identification of potential shooters. Although a recent study by the U.S. Secret Service Task Force looking at this did not identify a real single stereotype or profile that was someone that could be identified. But one thing we do know is that in the last about 40 mass shootings that have been investigated, the majority of them had some tell prior to the incident.
Right. And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment. The one-year anniversary of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shootings at 549-2937. Now, Jamie Rich, who publishes the statewide Flamingo magazine, you're an alumnus of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And within the pages of Flamingo this month is a really special issue, exclusive interviews with the kids, the survivors.
That's right.
Who've become really national household names in the year since.
That's right. Unlike other mass shootings, this one was really different. It was different for me, obviously, on a personal level, because as I was sitting in my office 1 year ago today, just going about the normal business of publishing, I started getting texts from my parents saying there's been a shooting at Douglas. You know, then the TV comes on, and you know, from there it was just an emotional blur of, you know, kind of watching your high school, you know, blown apart on national television. But yeah, we wanted to catch up with these kids because this shooting has been different. It's really changed the national debate. It's really gotten people angry on both sides. It's gotten reactions from both sides. It's kept things very fresh throughout the year, especially in South Florida, where the school is located and the communities there have really come together. Even being an alumni, we have a group that formed minutes really after the shooting started called MSD Mobilize. And there are 10,000 members of it now. And this is just a group of alumnus who are constantly working and doing things to move the conversation forward, to create change through events, through concerts, through sharing of information. And so what we've done with our story, The Faces of Change, is to reach out to the kids. Our writer sat down with them, interviewed a lot of the main players, some of the ones who originally started March for Our Lives. They had just some amazing inspirational things to say. It's a tragic reason for them to come together, but the takeaway for them is really that this work is so inspiring for them and they're really able to do something beautiful out of it together.
You interviewed, as we heard earlier in the show, David Hogg, Emma Gonzalez, Delaney Tarr.
Right.
And some of the other faces of this movement.
Right. We interviewed Delaney. We interviewed Lauren Hogg, David's sister. We interviewed a lot of the key people, even Jeff Foster, who is the teacher who kind of helped galvanize, coach the kids through all of this, really became their mentor and helped guide them to navigate this really uncharted territory. But it was his class that Emma was taking, the AP government class, where she had basically prepared her speech for a class. That became famous, you know, we call BS, but it was really Jeff Foster's class that had prepared these kids already and on these issues and thinking about it ahead of what.
And I remember that a year ago when they appeared on television and they were so incredibly well-spoken, people were saying they must be crisis actors.
Exactly.
These can't actually be high school students, but it's because this was a really good high school and they were prepped in debate.
Exactly.
Did you take that class too?
I did not take that class. When I was in school, Jeff Foster was not a teacher there, but he is an amazing individual. And some of the things that I took away from what he had to say were basically that, you know, it's a different environment now and everything has changed the way they teach the curriculum. He's still obviously teaching about special interest groups like the NRA and others. But he has to be sensitive to how his colleagues will react to any material or how the students will react to material. So, you know, they're operating in a different world.
Yeah, we all are. And we want your calls as we mark the 1 year anniversary of Parkland. Let us know, by the way, what you think of the push to get a ballot amendment on the Florida ballot in 2020 that would essentially ban assault weapons in the state. Let us know what you think about that. It's 549-2937 to join us. And as you write about in Flamingo, Jamie, in the last year, Florida has passed new gun legislation. They increased the legal age to buy a rifle from 18 to 21. Bump stocks have been banned. There's been an uptick in youth voting, a big one. The March for Our Lives movement has nearly 200 local chapters. Dr. Crandall, the House of Representatives, is expected to pass a sweeping background checks bill. It's not likely to pass the Senate, but it will be a symbolic move. State legislatures have passed 67 gun control or gun violence prevention bills in the last year. 8 states and Washington, D.C. have passed extreme risk protection orders. These are red flag laws. They allow a family member or law enforcement to petition the court to temporarily block a high-risk person from owning or buying firearms. Prominent gun control advocates have been elected to Congress. The group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America has really emerged as well in the last year. Mothers of the movement, as they're called, who have lost children to gun violence. One of them was Lucy McBath. Her son, Jordan Davis, was killed here in Jacksonville a few years ago on Black Friday in 2012. She has been elected to Congress up in Atlanta. And so over the last year, we've seen an enormous amount of movement on this issue. But at the same time, there are so many other Americans who are alarmed by this. Just this morning, as I was listening on NPR to a student from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas who lost his sister last year. And he told the host, you know, look, I still believe in the Second Amendment strongly because I feel that it's necessary to prevent, to fight back against a potential future tyrannical government. And so, you know, when you talk about this issue, that comes up again and again. That fear that if guns are removed from our possession or tightly restricted, we lose the ability to defend ourselves in the event there's a tyrannical government at some point in America.
Yes, and I understand that. It's written into in Second Amendment of the Constitution, and there in the history of the world, there have been many tyrannical governments. And the psychology of owning weapons, children are more likely to carry firearms to schools. Adults are more willing or are more interested in carrying firearms. It's more acceptable to carry firearms if they are afraid. that of violence in their communities or directed toward them. Bullying is a frequent trigger for children to carry firearms to schools. So it's the psychology of weapons carrying is often for self-protection. The reality of that is different. So we know that if you own a firearm, you're 8 to 20 times more likely to have that firearm used against you or used against a family member than you are to use it for self-protection. And that's, you know, that's challenging for some of us who understand, and we're Americans, and we're surrounded by images of people defending themselves with firearms successfully.
And so you feel safer if you have a weapon in your home or nearby, right.
but
you're
really
saying the
true.
Data shows the reality is you're actually less safe. It's more likely to be used in a way that harms you or yours.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. And I'm just as American as everyone else. I watch, you know, action movies and I feel that viscerally, but I do know it to be a fact that having a firearm in the house is dangerous to you, your family, youth in particular, especially if firearms are stored. And are not stored safely. The flip side of that too is the tyrannical government argument. And I would say you may feel that way, but we know that when government wants to get involved with an individual or an organization, they're not going to come with handguns or firearms or shotguns. They're going to come with rocket launchers like Waco.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Lots of tweets about this. Brian tweets the show, unfortunately, I think very little has changed in Jacksonville. If you follow JSO's Twitter account, that's the sheriff's department, you see a grim picture of gun-related violence and crime in our city. I've created the hashtag JacksGunViolence to sporadically track this gun violence in Duval County. Lots of other tweets coming into the show about this. Jamie Rich, you know, when you interviewed the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas kids, they've really become the face of this movement. Did you ask them how they come down on this issue when they talk to people who disagree, you know, who say, look, I'm sorry for what happened, but I'm not going to change my position on the Second Amendment, or I'm not going to ever support your push for more gun restrictions?
Right. I think that they have a really sensible argument with that in terms of, you know, they just say we want common sense gun laws. They're not trying to take away anyone's guns. They're not trying to rewrite the Second Amendment, but they do want more legislation. They want people to be educated. They want there to be just a whole scale approach to, yes, mental help with people who have mental instability, school safety beyond just having the armed guardians. And I think, you know, they have a real common sense way of thinking through it. And they aren't just irrational and emotional about it. These are smart kids. And one of the things I've taken away from what they have to say anyway is they really are the future that we'll be living. They are the mindset. They are galvanizing their troops, if you will, their 18-year-old troops. And they're really getting a lot of movement behind this. And what they are doing now, the work they're doing now, is going to be our reality 5-10 years from now, maybe sooner.
It's 549-2937. Dylan is in Arlington. Hey, Dylan, good morning.
Hi, I'm just calling in. I heard you guys talking earlier about the common argument that the Second Amendment is a protection from a tyrannical government. And I just wanted to contextualize as a veteran. Today, an assault rifle doesn't protect you from, guided missile destroyers and Abrams tanks and the vast arsenal that our massive military budget has brought to bear. So I understand why people think that they can protect themselves from their government with an assault rifle, but the arms race has just been drastically lost already.
And you say that as a former veteran. How did you serve, Dylan?
I'm in the Navy.
Oh, you're still in the Navy. Okay. Well, thank you for that call. So there's a psychology around this, Dr. Crandall, that sort of, I guess, belies the data. I think it's kind of similar to the thinking that, well, I'll feel safer driving somewhere than flying, even though the reverse is true. You're statistically safer when you're flying than when you're out on the roads, but you feel safer when you have control of a car and you're driving it.
That's exactly right. It
is this what is that the is that kind of the dynamic?
It is.
You feel like you're in control if you have the weapon nearby.
Right. Absolutely. And it is exactly likened to feeling safer when you're driving because you have control of the vehicle. They estimated that after 9/11 with the airplane-based attacks that commercial flights went down significantly, and they were able to attribute something like an extra 2,000 to 5,000 deaths on the roads because people were driving instead of flying.
Now, a minute ago, Jamie, you mentioned the program of armed safety assistance in schools. In Duval County, there's a lawsuit that's been filed by a group of local parents as armed safety assistants are going to be placed in elementary schools around town. These parents are arguing that only sworn police should be put on campus with weapons. We spoke about this the other day with Duval County School Board Chairwoman Lori Hershey. Take a listen.
The board responded to legislation that was passed and signed by Governor Scott at the time from House Bill 7023, which required armed person on each school campus. Since we already had that at the middle and high school level, we had to add that at 103 of the elementary schools. What we have done is we have partnered with the sheriff's office for schools where we do not have in place a school safety assistant. We are working with the sheriff's department now to have policemen there. But the goal is to have a school safety assistant.
Okay. And some districts around Florida, not in Duval or Northeast Florida, they're actually bringing Glocks into the schools. At the same time, the Florida Senate is considering a proposal to arm teachers. That is not likely to pass here in our part of the state, but it could in some other counties. And so when you spoke with the kids from March for Our Lives, did they touch on that at all?
They did not touch on having the armed guardian in their school. But I think, you know, one of the things that people, it's very easy to get emotional or be shocked by the idea of a teacher, quote, having a gun. But these guardians are highly trained. They're not just given a gun and walked in with a sticker on their shirt. I mean, they have gone through intense firearms training for weeks and weeks and weeks. These are people who are very skilled at using their firearm on a daily basis. And that's something that's just very lightly considered with a very thin training. These are people who know how to use the weapons and know how to use them to protect the students that they're in the school to protect.
Brian is in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Brian. Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Okay, Brian, give us a call back. Dr. Crandall, the armed safety assistants in Florida schools, where do you come down on that?
I think it's a fallacy. I think there are much better ways to invest in the safety of children, including more stringent gun laws such as universal background checks, which I applaud the bipartisan effort in Congress, and the assault weapons ban, as well as ban on high-capacity magazines and youth access-focused laws.
Here's a tweet, meanwhile. Please talk more about guns and suicide. Most people don't know that the likely outcome of owning a gun is suicide, not self-defense. More people die from a weapon by suicide than homicide in this country.
Absolutely.
As well.
There are about 20,000 firearm-related suicides in the United States every year.
And how do you see that when in your capacity as a trauma surgeon?
So we see it is the combination of impulsivity and lethality of means, as well as easy accessibility. So there have been many studies that have demonstrated that firearms that are stored unsafely, i.e. unlocked, loaded, are more likely to be used in homes of completed suicides than in control families who are, let's say, depressed. And this is true for youth and adult. So simply having a firearm in the house is an independent risk factor for suicide. That's been demonstrated in multiple states, multiple studies. And it's simply because you may be suicidal, you may be depressed, but it's harder to kill yourself with
if you
a
don't
knife
have the access.
It's just pretty simple, user friendly.
Okay, Brian is back on in St. Augustine. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Good morning. You know, there's a lot of talk about the guns, but there's not a lot of talk about people's behavior and attitude towards using a gun on another person. And I've been personally involved in four separate occasions where a gun was pointed at me. And in no instance did I feel compelled to have a gun and to use it against that other person. And, you know, I'm still alive. And when I relate these stories to people, they say, well, you would have been justified in using your gun, meaning lawfully I could have shot that person and, you know, ultimately killed them. But my point is, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to kill someone just because they accost me with a gun? I mean, it's like the American attitude towards killing is just so illogical. It's just not. It's It's really disturbing.
And are you talking about the state stand your ground law, Brian, where the ancient castle doctrine that you can defend yourself in your home, that has now been expanded out into the public sphere in Florida?
Well, I mean, there's certainly that. But even without the mention of stand your ground, just the fact that the belief is that if someone assaults you with a gun, that you have every right to assault them back. Meaning you should arm yourself and be prepared for that. And I disagree with it. And I'm, like I say, a victim of gun violence. I wasn't shot, but I still argue the point that arming yourself isn't a solution, period.
Thanks for that, Brian. That's Brian in St. Augustine. Here's an email from another listener. I don't own any guns, but if a criminal, terrorist, or mentally unstable person comes into a public place like a school and starts hurting the kids, as a parent, I'm not concerned about who stops them from causing harm, whether it's another parent with a gun, a teacher, a janitor, or a police officer. What parents won't do is to say that citizens with a gun don't stop the killer and wait for the cops to get there. Okay, so two points of view, I think, reflecting the divide in this country on this issue. And, Jamie Rich, publisher of Flamingo Magazine, whenever we touch on this subject, we the emails and calls and tweets that come in classically reflect the divide
right
over this issue.
I think we're all divided. I think you can hear it in the voices even of the kids in the story, in all of the interviews and all the media that's out there where they're some of them are saying, look, my parents have guns in the house. I'm not anti-gun. I just want to feel safer at school. And, my husband's in law enforcement and, I'm also have conflicted feelings on all of this, but I want schools, I want public places to be safer. I want to see, tougher gun legislation. And I'm really proud of the moves that have already been made. I think it was super impressive to see how swiftly things were changing in Florida last year, right after this happened. But I'd like to see more. And I still think that a lot of people struggle with the balance of owning a gun in your home, or if you want some armed guardians or armed teachers on your campus. But I think the main thing is that it's sparked real conversations. People are really thinking about how to better protect organizations in general, not only schools, but things have changed. They continue to change. I think people want them to change even more. And instead of having a sort of superficial level of security, have real measures in place that are robust enough that address all the issues, especially with taking guns away from people who are at risk with mental health issues. I think that's another important piece of this legislation that passed last year.
Right. Dr. Crandall, what about that? We don't have a so-called red flag law in Florida. A lot of other states have passed that, though, where you're able to prevent someone who is showing signs of mental disturbance or violence. You're able to prevent them from getting a weapon. It seems like common sense.
I do believe that's common sense. It's along the same continuum of having of folks who are convicted or charged with domestic violence offenses to not have access to weapons because of the likelihood of intimate partner homicide. So it's all along the same. It makes sense. But I will tell you, I'm conflicted because I'm American. I think we all are conflicted. But you know who's not conflicted? Europeans. Australians, they don't have mass shootings. They don't have mass casualty incidents and, the huge firearm-related homicide rate that we have in our country, because virtually all of our excess homicides are due to firearm-related homicides because it's easy to shoot people. And that doesn't mean that there isn't violence in other countries. In fact, the interpersonal violence rate, the arrests for violent crime, are just as high, if not higher, in the UK as they are here, but they just don't kill each other because it's harder to if you're using your fists than a firearm.
The U.S. Is overwhelmingly an outlier among developed countries when it comes to this issue. There's no other country, honestly, that even comes close.
No other developed country, right?
Yeah. How do the numbers shake out?
You just have to look at a graph. The per capita homicide rate in some communities in the United States is over 100 per 100,000, up to 200 or 300 per 100,000, and that just doesn't exist in other countries where it's half per 100,000.
Okay, and here's an email from Anna. Great discussion this morning. I believe we should have an amendment to ban assault weapons. I am so proud of and impressed by today's youth. These young leaders are making positive change. Here's a tweet from Maria. I knew these kids would be the ones to make changes. I'm glad to see they are still working hard. And so, Jamie Rich, your issue of Flamingo is coming out any day now.
Yes.
And people can read all over the state. This magazine is available. Can read the stories of the Parkland kids.
That's right. We have the story online now. We wanted to, last year after this happened, you know, we thought a lot about, you know, we definitely want to do something special 1 year from now, follow these kids, follow what's happened with the debate. And in the meantime, we also have published other essays from readers who really writing and storytelling is healing for people. So that's something that we've tried to use Flamingo to do with this issue, especially because it touches so close to our state and our and to me personally. But yeah, people can read the story now on flamingomag.com. The magazine will be on newsstands statewide starting the first week of March. But really, we wanted to keep it positive and we wanted to just find out, you know, what good things have come out of all of this terrible tragedy. And I think it's unity in a lot of ways and just the galvanization of this youthful army of people who really want to see change. And I think that they're going to continue to gain strength and to gain numbers across the nation, not just in Florida.
Go to flamingomag.com, pick up the issue on newsstands in March. Thank you so much, Jamie Rich, alumni of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, publisher of Flamingo Magazine, and Dr. Marie Crandall, trauma surgeon at UF Health Jacks and a nationally renowned researcher on gun violence. Thank you both so much for being here with us on this somber day.
Thank you.
Much more still to come. Keep listening. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Get expert advice on visiting the Acropolis in Athens.
The Acropolis and the museum together, they complete each other.
See what it takes to be a true adventure diva.
Having the confidence and the tools to change their lives is what it's about.
And discover the complicated roots of those polite Scandinavians.
You have to behave. If not, the Viking in me might come out.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on Jazz Night in America, East meets West, and the West meets the East. Tabla master Zakir Hussain and bass legend Dave Holland share with us Cross Currents, a world of ideas flowing between India and America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is what teachers are saying about Teach.
I loved how engaging he was.
My favorite part was definitely the breakout session.
It was just so relevant to the things that we're experiencing today.
You must attend this conference. This is the best conference I think I've ever been to.
Join us on Saturday, March 2nd for a day filled to engage, empower, and inspire you. The day includes keynote presentation, breakout sessions, and so much more. Tickets are $35. Log on to wjct.org/teach for more information.
Welcome back. Well, they have been filling the void around Northeast Florida for years now, and Void Magazine just marked a monumental milestone, the publication of their 100th issue. Here with more, Void publisher and president Ty Wallace and editor-in-chief Matt Shaw. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Morning, Melissa.
Morning, morning. Thanks for having us.
And congratulations, Matt. You've got your 100th issue now. That is quite an achievement. Tell us about what's inside.
Okay. It's 100 pages, so it's you know, a little beefier than our typical run. But, you know, this is my 10th issue. So there's, you know, there was 90 issues before me. And so for me, not even living here when these guys, Ty's partners, started the magazine, it was fun for me to kind of look back at the history of the magazine and talk to them and talk to other Void family members and extended family members and find out a little history of how it all started, because, you know, there was this prevailing narrative that the magazine like grew out of this surf report, which, you know, surfjackspear.com, which was, you know, site specific, you know, you get on there and check the waves, see if you're going to surf that day. And there's truth to that, but it's also, you know, bigger than that. And it kind of, things kind of grew from there.
Yeah, it started with the surf culture, but it's really encompassing a lot more than that now, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think it's, for some people, it might sound like a leap, but I think it's a natural extension when you look at surf and skate culture. Like, there's artists and business owners and, you know, musicians and all kinds of people who, you know, surf or skate, but they also do these other fabulous things. And so it was a natural extension to cover those people and to grow out of that.
And by the way, if you pick up the 100th issue, there's a list of Void fillers. And I'm so excited that myself and WJCT, we made the 100 list. So thank you for that. That was really cool to see.
Of course you did. No
thank
brainer.
Thank you.
No brainer there.
Ty Wallace, tell us how Void got started and how it's evolved over the years.
Yeah, like Matt said, it did start from a surf report called surfjackspear.com. And, you know, it was really out of a functionality for us. We had so many friends beating down our door like, hey, how's the surf? Our office had an agency at the beach right across the street from the Jacksonville Beach Pier before it was built, actually. We're always asking about the surf. So that was the function of that. And then from there, it evolved very quickly. You know, we started producing all types of content that was on the site outside of just surfing, arts, culture, entertainment. And from there, it was like, let's do a print publication. And so that's where Void was born.
Okay. And, you know, it's cool to see the growth of Void because there are so many different worlds in Jacksonville. There's the urban core, there's the suburbs, there's the north side, there's the west side, and then there's the beaches. Mm-hmm. And I think Void does a really good job in particular of capturing what's going on at the beaches.
Yeah. And I that's definitely the goal to, you know, and it's a monumental task to cover like this big area too. But I think just living in a growing city like this makes that all the more fun and all the more redeeming to cover the things that are happening, social, cultural movements that are, you know, kind of making the city such a good place to live.
So the magazine has grown along with the city and the beach communities.
Exactly. And that was kind of the point of that Void fillers thing. It's like, you know, some of them are a little superficial, like, you know, artisan donuts or acai bowls or whatever. But when you look at those things combined with like a thriving, like third wave coffee scene, plus a great public radio station, you know, hip hop and rock and roll and all the arts and culture things that are happening, like that really paints a picture of a thriving city.
Did you name the magazine Void after the empty space inside a wave? Is that what it, I mean? That's what I kind of figured that was referencing, but that's not what it is.
Not quite. Okay. Actually, that's interesting. I like that perspective, but we get this question asked a lot, but it actually is the void of a missing kind of that contact of the community to an actual, you know, publication that's really speaking to the things for the millennial market. It was a big thing. I think we learned that over time, though. I don't think we really were doing that naturally when we started to produce the content for Void magazine. But ultimately, yes, it was just filling that the space of the arts and culture and entertainment and that entrepreneurial spirit, I think, for our city that we weren't seeing done in a print publication.
Yeah, and that's something that I learned when, like, just researching and talking to these guys about the founding of the magazine. Just, like, if you look at the timeline, 2009, when the magazine came out, this was, like, an era of, like, declining print revenues and smaller publications and stuff. And so for them to have the foresight to know that there was an audience that would be responsive to a new, you know, print publication in 2009, you know, the worst economic climate we'll probably ever experience in our lives. It's kind of...
That was a leap of faith.
Yeah. Most were screaming print is dead at that time as well. So I think it was we're a bit bullheadish, you know, saying, hey, we're going to do this, whether it succeeds or not. We were passionate about it. So
yeah,
that was
and people
a big
are
driver.
Still screaming that today. And here we are, 100 issues. So
yep. Cheers.
So how'd you make it when others failed? What's your secret?
Grit.
That's the secret to a lot of things, isn't it?
isn't it?
Yeah, that's a proprietary knowledge that we can't share on the radio.
Well, and beyond the print publication, which, by the way, you brought a copy of the 100th issue with you here into the studio. It looks great as I look through it. Beyond the print publication, you guys have a strong social media presence, great website. Look for Void Live online as well. And as you celebrate this, you have a big event coming up that is going to be, of course, at the beach, at Surfer the Bar. And so this looks like a lot of fun. Tell us what's going to be happening. What's all on the agenda here?
Yeah, so it's this Saturday, Saturday the 16th. We have all, it race starts at 1 o'clock. We have our little shop, sip and shop, local vendors market from 1 to 6 p.m. I think we have over 20 plus vendors. Again, that's kind of bringing our publication to real life, and everything we do, we're bringing it to our event as well. And we have live music all the way to close, including the Mother Gooses. Little shout out for Matthew Shaw over there.
Who's that?
Do you play in that band?
I do, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the editor gets his band in this show.
What instrument do you play?
I play bass.
Of course you do. That makes total sense. Okay, so not only are you the editor of Void, you play in a band, which is even more reason to come out to this event. This is coming up Saturday night at Surfer the Bar. Now, what's next for Void? Now that you've marked this big milestone, what are your goals for growth and continuing on?
I think like it's pretty, to me, it seems pretty easy. Like what we talked about earlier, just with the city growing so much, like I'm don't think we're going to be wanting for topics to cover. So, you know, continue to, cover all different parts of the city and, continue to give artists, musicians, entrepreneurs a platform, you know, via this magazine.
Yeah. To add to that, I'll drop a little, it's coming soon. We're actually moving our office. We have an interesting compound concept that we're going to be introducing, including another publication into our lineup. But with Void in general,
what's it going to be called?
Oh, coming soon.
Okay. We'll have to stay tuned.
Yep. So, but with Void in general, I think we've realized a lot of these, we do this in-house music series, which we're doing all kinds of bringing our content and the print publication to life inside our office. So that's kind of a little liaison into our new office concept as well. So you're going to see more Void and more in-house kind of productions happening there as well.
Kudos. Well, thanks guys for sharing this with us. And thanks for including us in the Void 100 as Void marks 100 issues. Ty Wallace is Void's publisher and president. Matt Shaw, editor-in-chief. Congratulations.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Come on out to the Void 100 issue party at Surf of the Bar Saturday night in Jacksonville Beach. And coming up, the author of Valentine's Day Poems for Married People. Yeah, if you're married, you want to pick up a copy of this book. We'll be right back.
Players' Championship moves to March. The drama unfolds on the Island Green March 12th through the 17th with the all-new Players' Welcome Experience, featuring the PGA Tour Fan Shop and a variety of local restaurants. Tickets and parking today at theplayers.com.
Coker Law wants you to know if you or a loved one has been injured through the negligence of a driver, business owner, or defective product. They can help. Learn more at CokerLaw.com.
A high school senior could soon lose her parents. She'd have to take care of her sisters and find a job.
So that'd mean I had to drop out of school before I even start college. We'd have to sell the house we have right now.
That's because her parents are set to lose temporary protected status. They could be sent back to El Salvador if Congress doesn't act soon. How ending TPS would break up families on the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Much has changed in this economy and society since 2010, and the Census Bureau, well, they're catching on.
For the first time ever, the Census Bureau is going to be asking the majority of Americans to answer the census online.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The census goes from clipboards to computers. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The war on terrorism is far from winding down. New evidence suggests U.S. forces are engaged in countering terrorism in 80 countries spread across 6 continents. Just who and where are we fighting, and what impact is it having? America's expanding fight against terrorism overseas, that's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, John Kenny's collection of satirical love poems for married people was first published in The New Yorker for Valentine's Day 2 years ago, and it took off. Kenny released a compilation of these and other poems in a new book. It's called Love Poems for Married People. Take a listen. John Kenny, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
I have to tell you, every married person around our office that has read your poems has laughed out loud. I think you've really tapped into something profound about what it's like to be married. And so, I'm curious to ask you how you decided to start writing about marriage in this way, in poetry form, but in a really kind of sly, humorous way.
Yeah, especially considering I'm not a poet, and anyone who reads my poetry will realize that very quickly. And I am the least expert person on relationships and marriage. I have been contributing off and on to the New Yorker magazine for a number of years, and I had written a piece a few years back called Valentine's Day Poems for Married People, a very silly little collection, 6 or 8 poems, and They seem to get an interesting response. People kind of liked them. And so my publisher last summer asked me to turn it into a book of a bunch of poems. And so I spent last summer in like a 6-week sprint to put this together. So it was an interesting challenge.
Well, it came out, the sprint was successful. Now, are these just based on experiences you've had with your wife? And by the way, what does she think of these poems?
Her legal team. These are completely made up, Melissa. They're not real.
All right, right. No basis in reality.
No. They take. I asked a lot of friends for thoughts, and what was really interesting was the universality of relationships, short-term, long-term, married, living together, gay, straight. It was remarkable how similar the themes were of annoyance or boredom, or it's just the little peccadilloes that make living with someone every single day interesting. I can't say enough about my wife's help, Lissa, to whom I dedicated the book. We've been married for 14 years, my best friend, and she's a wonderful writer and editor. So my job was to make her laugh out loud, which is a hard thing to do. I missed the mark a lot of times, so we trashed those poems, but I really would not have been able to do this without her help.
That's nice. Well, could you do us a favor and read one of the shorter ones for our listeners?
Sure. Sure could. How about And again, this does not come from any personal experience.
Okay.
Having been married for 14 years, it's called Why Are You in the Shower with Me? Did the bathtub shrink? I ask, because here we are, naked, showering together like we once did all the time. Remember at the beginning? We would stand and talk, seals slipping by one another, a playful ease letting the other into the stream. Now, I'm not sure what you're doing in here. I'm freezing. There's shampoo stinging my eyes. You just stepped on my foot. For the love of Christ, who flushed the toilet? Because I'm being scalded alive. Get out now. It was a nice idea, though, honey. Could you close the door?
Yes, I think that kind of captures it. You know, marriage is that deal where you both share the memory of what your relationship used to be like.
That's right.
And so in a sense, that keeps you together because you have those really romantic memories, even though the relationship is very different today. That's just our fate as human beings when we make that lifetime commitment to each other, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I forget who said it, but there's that great quote, a successful marriage requires falling in love many times, always with the same person.
Right.
And that's sort of what it is, because it's impossible to realize when you're 25 or 30 and madly in love and, you know, your body racing with all those sort of good chemicals, that it's going to change. And I don't mean that in a bad way at all. It simply changes. Like, all things change. And, you know, kids, mm-hmm. weekends aren't quite the same with kids as they are when you're sort of sleeping in until 9 o'clock and whatever. And life and stress and jobs and in-laws and things. And your ability to get through that and see that is going to take not taking yourself and the marriage too seriously, right?
Right.
You have to take it deadly seriously, but you better be able to laugh at it.
I think that's why your book has hit such a nerve, because marriage is hard. Raising kids is hard. Keeping the family unit and the house and the jobs going, it's all so hard.
Oh,
and people
so,
need to laugh. Difficult. We need to
yeah.
laugh about it, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's madness. It's madness what you sort of go through. I mean, I will say, not to sound like a sap, but, you know, I've been with my wife 16 years. We've been married 14. I mean, you know, I love my wife more now than when I met her, and I didn't think that was possible because, you know, you go through so much, right? Life throws so much at you, and what it asks you is, what is your ability to juggle?
That's right, isn't it? All right. It's Love Poems for Married People by author John Kennedy. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. Have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.